the set dressing in a film, the background characters are just as important as anything else that's going on. In fact, that's what sets the baseline for everything. So in order to have like a compelling conversation between two characters where you're bought in and all they're doing is having a coffee in a diner, you have to hear the plates rattling. You have to hear someone pouring coffee. You have to see the waitress walking around. You have to see the couple sitting over there. That's what we kind of have people focus on, right? It's like, okay, extract normalcy from the environment, right? That's how life works, is like all of that background noise, everything that's happening, that's where you get what's going on in the situation. It's not the novel thing that pops up in the main character that walks through, because that's easy. Welcome to the Left of Greg podcast. Hello, and thank you for tuning in to the Left of Greg podcast. I'm Brian Marin, the host and creator of the show. As always, I will be joined by human behavior expert, Mr. Greg Williams, who the show is affectionately named after. Here on the Left of Greg show, our goal is to increase your advanced critical thinking ability through a better understanding of what we call human behavior, pattern recognition, and analysis. If you'd like to find out more about what that is, you can check the episode details. If you have any questions or would like us to cover a specific topic, please reach out to us at leftofgreg@gmail.com. Today, we are expanding on some of the same themes we discussed in our last episode, but rather than talking about music, we're talking about movies and TV shows and how you can use your favorite shows to better understand human behavior in general. During the episode, we give a number of examples of how movies and TV shows have to follow a certain algorithm in order for us to suspend disbelief, and we point out how certain storylines will continue to repeat over and over, just like they do in real life. We also give some tips on how you can get better at conducting predictive analysis in real life by using some of your favorite films as examples. Please don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find the links in the episode details, and if you enjoyed the podcast, please share it with your friends. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Left of Greg podcast. And good morning, Greg. I'm curious real quick what the current temp is up in the Rockies in Colorado.
Holy crap. So I've got this link to the outside. Let me tell you.
Because
it just turned 15.
Oh, that's so good. That warmed up, actually.
15 times warmer than yesterday.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So, yesterday 15 was our high, so I hope that's not happening,
because it's
pitch dark out.
We in San Diego got down into the low 30s the last couple nights, so we had some frost, which is not good for the avocado trees out here. So that's the big 30 is really damaging.
Isn't
things.
Frost on the avocado a euphemism for something?
Yeah, I don't know.
Song, I think.
That's not something that I want to know what that even means.
No.
But today's topic is we're actually figured follow up from the previous episode on music is now do movies. And I don't know why I didn't think of that when we were doing the music one, but it's a natural sort of progression.
Movie smoking the kind bud and both of us forgot.
Movies are, because it's storytelling and not unlike how music is, but there's similar, it's another great analogy to human behavior at pattern recognition, because they all revolve around patterns, excuse me. And so there's a ton we can learn from movies and about human behavior, about ourselves and what we're watching and society as a whole. And you don't have to drill down into the details of the movies. You just look at it from a sort of formulaic perspective and the elements of what needs to be in there, because those are elements from real life, now maybe exaggerated or personified in some other manner or however they want to tell the story. But either way, there's certain elements that have to be there. So every movie and successful movie and TV show, unless you're into some very, very unique things, it has to follow.
Let's not go there. We're back to the avocado.
They have to follow certain algorithms. Within those different algorithms, within those elements that have to be in there, this is also why, and we'll talk about this in the episode, why we see like prequels and sequels, why Hollywood keeps doing remakes of stuff, which is actually a great point on that, I think, is that it shows how hard it is to be creative and unique and novel, even in a creative industry such as Hollywood movie making.
Yep.
It's very difficult to come up with something new that works and is entertaining. So it's really, really difficult. And then we'll also talk about, I want to get into why people binge watch, how we see ourselves within the movies, and kind of what it all means. So I'm not sure where you wanted to start today, but I know you do have kind of a quote about movies and about their length and stuff. So I don't know if you wanted to start there. I'll let you do
that. That's a great place to start. So look, these Gregisms don't end because I just say what's on my mind. A long time ago,
sometimes you're detriment. Film.
Yeah, it's not always a trait that you clap afterwards. But you know, I love film. And so I've been a lover of film since I was a little kid. And my quote was, most films are about an hour too long, because I love film, and I love how people tell film. But it's almost as if in many films that I watch that somebody's looking at the clock and going, dude, we got to have 20 more minutes, one more fist fight. And I hate that shit. I love when I get the point of a film and it's beautifully shot and well acted and the script is good, I can go back to it over and over, and we'll talk about that. But what I found, you have a great way of sizing it up. Every generation vilifies the next generation or the previous generation, right? Well, it's the same with me, because you know my taste in music is all over the place. Well, my taste in film is all over the place too. And what I reach out to is that stress reducing, enjoyment gathering, if it's a CGI film, unless it's some stunning, amazing thing, I'm not excited.
I don't get any of those.
And so listen, and we also share a trait that our listeners and our viewers and our stalkers probably would be interested in, is that, you and your wife do exactly what, Shelly and I do, is we have a time where we watch films at home. And we have the 15-minute rule.
Yeah.
And I've heard recently that you have the same rule, you know?
So, you know, to kind of jump into kind of a good starting point, too, is those films and what we, because you're bringing it up right here, is that when we say they have to follow a certain algorithm, there has to be certain elements, it's about setting patterns. So it has to be engaging to me, just like music, but it has to fit within what the confines of what I expect to see. And then when there's a little bit of irony or a little bit of discourse or a little bit of incongruence, it's good. My brain clams on and go, ooh, I wasn't expecting that.
Yes.
I want to continue. So now it's engaging. But if it's too much or too little, then it's like, or if it's too much, then I'm like, this is all over the place. I don't understand it. Boring. Right.
Okay. Around Christmas time, they show a couple of films about, for example, in Christianity, about Jesus. And I won't name any of the films for attribution, but they're 4.5 hours long.
Oh, yeah.
Look, I love Jesus, but I didn't want to follow him the whole day. You get what I'm trying to say? I wanted to, you know, get in, get out after dinner or something.
Just give me some of the highlights. Give me his top five miracles. So
if you're going on just strict, hey, look at the beauty in this 9.5 hour epic, I'm not interested. You know, I want something that captures my attention early, that keeps my attention, or inattention. And that's an odd policy, right? Because sometimes we choose a film as background noise. And that's an important discussion as well. So I just like the idea. And the 15-minute rule, for those that are wondering, is that Shell and I, like Eric Corum, great doctor, keep up the great post.
Yeah, he puts up great
always
stuff.
Says 3-2-1. So 3 hours before bed, no food, 2 hours, no drink, 1 hour, no film. Well, Eric, I have a life. And as much as I'd like to follow that, when Shell and I finally get together, we sit in a dark room, we eat the popcorn, literally eat the popcorn, and watch a film. If that film doesn't gather both of our attention in 15 minutes, we broom it and go on to the next one. And I think that's a great policy, because we jointly look, if you're looking at the societal necessity of film, that's a perfect example. It brings us closer together. And we can spend hours after, whether it was a shitty film or a great film, talking about it. What else gives you that benefit for your, you know, the return for your investment?
Well, it goes back to the oldest form of knowledge and skill transfer is storytelling, right? So you're having this storytelling with this engaging experience with music and the lights, and it's executed in a manner that's meant to be engaging for the watcher. So you can really get into it. You can get lost to it. It opens up a new world. You can suspend disbelief. Your brain goes, got it. We're watching a movie. But it knows like this isn't a real thing.
So it's exactly. safe. It's okay. I can enjoy it. I can,
I'm okay.
I can even expand my boundaries to what I might be interested in versus in a normal situation, exactly. right? In an environment. And so you can, that's why part of the reason, you know, you're talking about psychological and sociological engagement yep. right there. One, especially you're enjoying it with your wife. A lot of people do that. I do that with Kaylee. And the same thing is like, if it's not capturing my attention in those first 15 minutes, I'm not in, yep. but we sort of have different standards where like she might be in the mood where she wants to watch something that really grabs her in. Sometimes we'll watch a movie where it's grabbing me in because of how slow it is going or what it's laying out. I'm like, hang on, this is different. They're really putting yes. something out here.
And so now it's engaging. You buy another 15 minutes, yeah, right? Yes. And I love that. Yeah. But see, that's the epitome of social connectivity because you want to belong. And so there, even in your relationship, you feel emotionally close to somebody else, and the film actually augments that. It helps right. that. The film is a vehicle, just like a good book. But you know what? That's why we have to form a book club, because unless I'm reading it to you and then you're reading me the next chapter, like I give you an example, it's a parallel. Shelly and I still love doing crosswords, and we were on a lot of flights where there weren't cell phones and there weren't movies and there weren't other things. So what I would do is I would do like the first three words and then pass it to her for the next three. And the idea was to see where her mind was and which clues she was getting a piece of, and see the hesitation marks where she wanted to fill in something that would give me the chance to ask, what do you think that is? And then we would talk, and people would go, you guys really take crosswords seriously. And it's like, yeah, because guess what? It's a safe harbor for us to pull into while we have to burn some time.
Yeah.
And it's a socially connective. We love that connective fire.
So right? so you're talking about sort of, which is great, this connection with the people you're watching the movie with, and yes. and you're also connecting with the characters in the story, right? And so yes. this is one of the, when we say, because we say this all the time, that all human beings have a very egocentric viewpoint. It's part of yes. just our survival. It goes back to the limbic system. We're concerned about us. Well, when it comes to watching a movie, it's a perfect example, because who do we see ourselves as, right? We're watching this movie going, I'm the protagonist. I'm the Jason Bourne. I'm this, you know, you're not yep. looking at it going, hey, see that guy, you know, cleaning up dishes on that back table in the restaurant of the scene. Hey, that's me. So you get to see yourself as yep. the hero, right? I mean, you really do.
And you feel betrayed when he's betrayed or she's betrayed. You feel enthralled when they discover something or get away. You know, you're right there on their heels. Or remember Peter Pan, where he lost his shadow and mm-hmm. Tink had to help him find it and yep. sew it back onto his heels. That's how we feel in those films. But it's not the obverse of that. The real universe is we should be watching that film and going, okay, pause. You see that guy behind Jason Statham, Jason Statham that's bussing the table?
Yeah.
Okay, that's more me.
Yeah.
You get what I'm trying to say? The guy that's the valet parking that car or mowing the lawn or something. And it's funny because the film, just like the book, allows that escapist fantasy. So that's why when you're talking about stress reduction or increasing one's emotional intelligence, Brian, that plus the benefits of talking about a film, one of the left of Greg, the whole reason that this podcast is named that is we'd be driving around and we'd be talking about a class, but you can't talk about class all the time.
Then, yeah.
Oops, stop of a lifetime drives by and we go, you know, that was exactly like that movie, this. And then we go off on a movie or a song, don't we?
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the 90 percentile yeah. things that Brian and I folks talk about when we're engaged somewhere. And why? We use a story. We'll go like, so last night on Family Guy, and that reminds me of the yeah. story. Everything has a relevant meaning to our lives or our class.
Most of our training classes are based predominantly on Family Guy. So
on Family Guy, and about 2/3 Family Guy, 1/3 Simpsons.
Yeah.
So
older
if you watch,
Simpsons.
Those yeah. exactly the early Simpsons. So if you watch those episodes, you don't need to come to class, folks. Just watch them and just send me a text, and we'll send you a thumbs up.
No, so
a yellow thumbs up for the Simpsons.
So this is kind of what I wanted to get into as well, yeah. because not just the storytelling aspect, but how knowledge and skill transfer works, and why you can't remember some really important information information that you need to know, right. But you remember every line of the movie Step Brothers or something like that, or some exactly. funny quote. And those, and we talk about memory emotion links on this, and that's what we were talking about with music as well. Is and it since the music episode too, I got some great feedback from everyone listening, uh-huh. and I appreciate that. And you know, it hearing a song allows you to recall so much more memory. And we talked about memory emotion links absolutely. And how those what happens in the brain with myelinization and creating neural pathways to all these different areas. Well, movies have that same effect because it's an experience. It's the sights, it's the sounds, it's the smell, it's that popcorn that you're eating, right? And it all gets sort of codified in there. So yep. when it's really funny or really scary, you remember all of those elements better. But, you know, that's something that, like, we made the joke about Family Guy or those movies, but we use those movie references throughout what we do because it ties, it can, you can tie a scene in a movie to a lesson. I just remembered this. When I think I was going through like even sniper school in the Marine Corps, it was like meant to be a Kim's game, but the instructor showed us, you know, if everyone's listening to Kim's game, it's, you know, the idea is, you know, you get good at recall by, you know, looking at a bunch of objects, remembering what they were, and then recalling them later. It's kind of like little games yep. for attention and for memory and just
came from the character Kim.
Rudyard Kipling character.
Yep.
You know, they showed us this clip from the movie Heat. You remember the scene where they bank robbed the bank and they're coming out, and you know, the point was they were going to ask us a bunch of questions about it. And hey, what was the billboard on the bus that drove by when they were shooting and this? So that the idea was just a game of attention and awareness and taking in the full entire yep. scene. Don't get looped in watching the popcorn. But, you know, even that, and part of the reason when it was interesting too, because that was when movies started using people with real tactical experience to help them yep. choreograph those films, because in that scene, it's very actually tactically sound how they break contact out of there. It's fire maneuver, and it's like textbook how you're supposed to do that, because they had brought someone, I think it was like, I don't remember who it was, maybe British SAS or something like that. It was, I remember it was someone from England, I think, but to show them, hey, this is how you do that. This is how you break contact, to kind of show the organization level of them. But the point I'm getting with that is those are powerful tools to use, even when teaching a lesson or pulling out good information from those, right? And this yep. is why they're so popular, and they turn into memes, and you know, you can get spread around because everyone, it's a shared common experience that everyone has, and if you can tie yes. a lesson back to that, it's so much more powerful, because it now, again, it helps the recall of what I'm trying to learn. So that's why yep. I love them too, and why we use them in pop culture, and you know, everyone's always talking about whatever the latest movie is, because it allows you to discuss certain topics underneath this sort of safety net of a movie. Does that kind of make sense?
Exactly. Because now it can occur in the movie. Like, for example, if you're testing what you like, or if you want to understand more about another person, you can gauge that with music and with film without being insulting. And, you know, another Family Guy reference, may I take a gander under your skirt? And it was at the Renaissance Festival, and they actually stick a goose under the lady's skirt. That's magic. But the idea that we could discuss something like that and you go, that's ridiculous. Well, now I know we're not going to go to airplane at the drive-thru, right? Yeah. Or at the drive-in. And I'll give you a quick example of what Brian's talking about, boys and girls. So, you know, it's like the 25th anniversary of Sopranos, so you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a Sopranos reference. Well, I was a true acolyte. I absolutely watched absolutely every episode that came out. And Shelley and I would create a watching time, and ours was on Sunday night, when generally we had this time away from the kids, and we would sit with a couple of good friends of ours, and we would watch, and then we'd discuss the episode. Well, in season 6, episode 6, there's a scene where Chris Moltisanti and Tony Soprano meet at Bada Bing. And Tony goes, hey, are you sure about that? You know, channeling my Tony. I don't want it to sound like Gilbert Gottfried.
That's your go-to character. That's your go-to character. I don't know why.
That's how I sound, I think. But he says, hey, Chris, he goes, yeah, there's two Arab gentlemen that you're dealing with. How do we know they're not Al-Qaeda? And which is great, because, again, it's Sopranos becomes a period film, right?
Yes,
because
absolutely.
What was popular back then. And so it's, you know, opening the history book. And Moltisanti goes right into fundamental attribution area. He goes, oh, no, Tone, these are good guys, man. I was over their house and they were having, ham chops in steak, you know. So he's going against all the different things that we've learned about the Arab culture that we think is important, for example, to a Muslim. And he was dancing around it. And it was hilarious because of how tongue-in-cheek it was. And then he says, they even own a Labrador Retriever. Okay, so the idea is that because they're a nice guy and they own a dog and all this other, well, they certainly can't be terrorists, right? You say it the best when you're talking about, you know, you go over to a guy's house and they, you know, they donated to whatever fund that you wanted. You go, that's a nice person, not knowing that they got human skin lampshades right inside the door.
Yeah.
But why is that? And yes, I consider Sopranos a film and not the new remake of the Sopranos film, right? But the idea is that a film can allow us to test things that we would never be able to test in real life and demonstrate things to somebody. Because like, if I try to demonstrate something I know to you, I might be hitting a brick wall because your experiences and mine are so different, but we can come together in the film and we can say, do you remember that scene? Well, what they meant by that scene, what was happening behind there? And then the other person says, you're full of shit. I've been to Boston and I know that's the socialization. Because if you are talking about just an escape mechanism, yes, it's proven physiologically to do certain things. But if you're talking about strengthening a relationship, a film is a great way to open all kinds of metaphors. Brian, how many times I got to talk Allegory of the Cape?
Yeah.
We keep looking at Boyd's Oodle Loop. Boyd's Oodle Loop equals shitty movie. Okay. Yeah. Allegory of the Cave. There's thousands of films
that's a great point. And I think it's more about how it's received versus how it's produced and conducted and delivered. So to your Boyd's Oodle Loop example. And it's like anytime a new study or a new thing comes out or someone writes a paper about something. What I've kind of found in a lot of this is like the intent of what was the initial research or whatever it was great and it was meant for a specific thing. And then everyone took it wrong. And then it grew from there. It's like, well, that's not really what I meant by that. You know what I'm saying?
Again, a fundamental attribution here. I've taken something that you spent a lot of time researching and creating, and now my bias is so there. He just proved my point.
That's the Boyd's Oodle Loop one. I think if he were alive today and he saw people, what they're doing, he'd be like, man, he'd be like, can you explain that to me? I don't know what you're talking
Boyd's
about.
Boyd's Oodle Loop helps me as a swimmer.
So here's one thing, because you actually, what another reason why I love film as this, it's great. It's great pop culture, you know, references throughout time that you can go back to, because you kind of hit on it there. So I want to jump into it, but
sure.
You know, a lot of folks will like look back at like older movies and be like, this blows, or this is slow, or this doesn't have this. And it's a great way when you look back at different historical events and, or different situations that happened or something someone did. And then you're judging it based on what you know, and you got to go, look, you got to understand this car chase scene in the French Connection. This was groundbreaking. No one had done something like that before, not a single word spoken for however long it is. And it's just you're dropped into this, intense sort of moment and you're on the edge of your seat. And that hadn't, like, so no, that's not the flipping 37 cars and CGI stuff you have now, because that wasn't available then. And that was groundbreaking. So you're looking at it as a time capsule sort of now and opening up and going, well, so much.
I love the time capsule. That's so great.
And then you look back to what people had to do. So I love films for that reason, because you can see the sort of the ebb and flow of how they start to change things. There's certain ones that are that have sort of an impact across the industry. But when it comes to those, you know, I always love it when someone from like, you know, today is like, well, those older movies, they suck and they're too slow. It's like, no, man, like you got to enjoy it for what it was.
Right. So another Gregism coming. Feel free to write them down and use them in your day. Just because it's old doesn't mean it's good, because like Turner Classic. Yeah. Okay. So that's my only, you know, that's my go-to, because I don't stream or web or whatever the new fucking term is. But I love film, and people ask all the time, why do you call it film instead of movies? I use both, but I prefer saying film because it's shot on film means something to me rather than like video and the other formats. And also movies is kind of bastardization of the language. What are they doing? Well, they're moving. Oh, so these are stills and these are movies, right? And so I just prefer the one.
You still call them talkies too.
Oh, yeah. I was there playing the piano. So the idea is that we get hooked that because it's a black and white, it's a classic. Or we start right up making some bullshit Hollywood movie and we go an instant classic. Nothing can be an instant classic.
Classic, right?
It's like a down elevator. Okay, those things can't exist. It's jumbo shrimp. They can't be there. So I say to you, the thing that brings you back to a film, like, for example, probably 2 weeks ago now, The King and I, it was with Chow Yun-fat and Jodie Foster, that old one. It was on a free channel. I taped it. So when I came back from our trip, Shell and I could watch it. Splendid film. Not the musical version, not the stage version. Then I do my research on it because I want to know where it was filmed. Like, I hate a film about Detroit that was filmed in Canada. I hate any film that was filmed in Canada. It's not about Canada. It's just ridiculous. The standard that we set to send all our money, to Canada. But back to this, I'm watching the film and then I read up about the female that wrote the book that the film's based on. And she was batshit crazy. She made up everything. She made up living in Egypt for years and her relationship and the definitions of the people that she met and things weren't historically accurate. Okay. But you know what? I understand when I click play that that's a film. It's not a documentary. I understand that I'm not opening.
Well,
do you see what I'm trying to say?
A lot of people don't
get that. Right. I agree with you. But I enjoy the idea that and the King and I have been done. That film has been done a number of times. We need to talk about that, too, why that is. But the idea is it hooked me. Jodie Foster, great character, loved her for her entire career. Gets off the base every once in a while, but it's okay. Elysium, I scream out Elysium. Shelley knows immediately what I mean because of all my ailments that could be healed. I loved her in Taxi Driver. I mean, look at what a character that she created and portrayed before anybody understood that it was acting. So there's such magic there. But the idea was that to find out the bitch slapper reality for me, that it was all hocus pocus and shit. But I appreciate that because that, again, gives me something to think about and invest my time in and research and talk to other people about and see how they feel about it. No other milieu other than music and film and literature, of course, allows you to do that, Brian. Most people aren't that creative.
That's the big thing. And to tell a compelling story to engage people is a lot more difficult than people realize, right?
I absolutely agree.
And that's why you see the repetitive nature of these films to literally, hey, let's do the reboot. Hey, it's been 20 years, let's do this.
Right.
Hey, let's get all the same actors back and they'll play this. It's like the different. It's like when they did that with Blues Brothers, they ruined the first one when they did it because it was so profoundly different. And it was like, no, man, that was such a it was a snapshot in time of a place that involved the music and this and the comedy and the stuff from Chicago and the folks at Second City were putting out all this stuff, like where a lot of these actors and SNL folks got their start and where this blossomed from the National Lampoon's guys. Like it was this thing, like you can't just redo that and slap
like
it.
Like Animal
slap
House
it
2.
Yeah, exactly. It would be terrible. Like you can't.
But Brian, I'll take this stand and we can discuss it from different points of view. Mine from a strictly financial or fiduciary relationship with film. So much easier for me to pitch something that's already been done and demonstrate that it made money. I don't have to scout locations. I know the kind of actor I want. The scripts have already been written, so maybe I gotta pump up the script a little bit, right? But the idea is that a film like The Star Is Born that's been done for every single generation. Okay, we got it. So the idea of all that extra money and work and hours can be put into a different part of the production or can be put in my pocket, right? Or the studio can save it. So many times the reboot is being lazy and just chasing the dollar. We have to be realistic.
Of course. But it also highlights the fact that there are really only so many stories to tell. Now, meaning
that milieu, I absolutely agree.
I mean, just across society, you can encapsulate people's stories you know, that are might be seem that the details are all wildly different, but it's the same thing. It's, hey, had this thing happen, got knocked down, had to get back up, got on top. I mean, that the hero.
It's Chumbawamba, by the way, but
oh, yeah.
Brilliant.
But the, yeah, it's like the whole hero's journey is replayed in every movie that's ever made. You know, not everyone, but within
The Iliad, the Odyssey, right? So the difference in literature, Brian, is literature fills libraries with hundreds of thousands of people's stories, but not all of them are compelling societally, because not all of them can we feel ourselves being a part of it.
Well,
get what I'm saying? Like my left foot might be an amazing struggle, but I can't associate with the character. So I like the book much more than I like the film.
This is how it relates back to sort of human behavior and how humans are, because there's only, you know, there's only so many different types of people. We all fall into that ice cube tray somewhere. I mean, we really do. And so there's limits to what you can and can't do. And movies play with that and they push it. And sometimes they do well, and sometimes they do poor, sometimes and everything gets exaggerated. And sometimes sometimes even actors then become that same character over and over and over again, because
in their entire career,
that's all
Will
they Ferrell's
have. A perfect example, because that's all he's got.
Yeah.
So compare that to a John Candy that could assume a whole bunch of different, in my humble opinion. So I want to touch on something that you just said. The idea that we repeat themes is so huge because we are a culture of patterns. And you said something that's going to insult a bunch of people. As much as we think we're different and unique, we're all the same.
We're not.
And somebody's going to say, well, wait a minute, I'm very different. Okay. There's five or six restaurants that are repeated in every gosh damn intersection for money at every small town while you're driving down the freeway. Why? Because that's where people like to eat. There's a Walmart in every town. And because Walmart has, I don't want to say disturbing, unique policies, if you want to hunt the serial killer, go park at the Walmart. You're going to find them sooner or later. But why Walmart? Because they offer great value for a low price, and you know where everything is in the store. I bet you can walk in any Walmart, and the same reason I go to the same hotel all the time.
Yeah.
You walk in any Walmart, you know
where
the left,
is.
The right, where everything is. You get in and out in no time at all. Hate self-checkout, another story. But the idea there, Brian, is that once that movie crosses that familiar territory, like for example, there's schlock. There's stuff that they put in films that's just not true, and it's become a Hollywood legend. So now it becomes a standard. The police officer with the bottle of booze in their desk.
Okay.
HR would have a field day. Your bosses would, you know, you got to take a blood, urine, semen, and stool sample every time you're in a use of force or a shooting. That doesn't happen. Every movie's insistence, from Jade to the Seagal flick to gosh damn, you just mentioned the one, Blues Brothers, where the pursuit pops up on a curb and goes through a restaurant, then hits a flower cart or a food cart, then goes through, and then you remember Jake and Elwood, Muppets, and turn it on the wipers. Okay, those type of things, we look forward to a film, even though the reality is that they never occur in real life. So what? So they become the urban legend, and when we don't see them, we get angry. So if you have to put it in a movie, you know, what do we call it? That buddy pick, you know, and then all of a sudden you're saying, okay, well, it's got to be a fish out of water. So, you know, one guy's got to be black and one guy's got to be white. One guy's got to be the dragon slayer. And guess what? His best friend ends up being the dragon that saves his life. Aesop wrote about that.
Yeah.
Come on. Those aren't new concepts, but why, Brian? Because those are the ones that hook us chemically. They hook our brain. They hook us physiologically.
That's sort of that looking for that familiarity, right? It can't have too much incongruence unless like it's obvious up front going in that everything in there is completely made up. And that's why those based on real events movies always do so well, and there's such a far stretch from what actually happened. Just watch any Any movie about the military in the last 20 years, you're like, that's not what happened in that operation.
Well, Tom Berenger taught you everything you need to know about being a sniper, didn't
exactly,
he?
Exactly.
But you're right. So listen, Max is 8 months now. You know, he's going to come up with a favorite toy or a favorite blanket, and that's going to go with him everywhere. and he's going to come up with a favorite sleeping position in different locations, in the car seat, in the crib, on the couch, right next to you. And the idea is when you look at those are comfort signals. And with a comfort signal, not only does my heart rate feel the definite benefit of it, but the electrochemical neurotransmitters in my body actually respond to them.
Yeah.
So the film that you repeat over and over and over, or the song, and hence the lyrics, becomes that security blanket. And so when I want to check out, when I want to relax, when I've got a project with a deadline and I want something burning in the background, I need it to be familiar. Why? Because my brain needs to be able to check out, not burn a whole bunch of calories and solve equations and do a effing Sudoku.
Yes.
Right? It needs to give me some payback. And my payback is that it's the warm comfort of the voices and the characters and the situations. And I go, is it cortisol and dopamine so, race through my system?
So here's where I want to get into kind of what we do with HPP RNA and teach people predictive analysis and how to do that and extract. And because you just set it up right there. So when I'm watching the movie, I'm you know, if it's good, I'm so bought into the moment that I didn't see that thing coming. I didn't, unless they wanted you to, unless they put out the breadcrumbs for something, unless it was deliberate, right? Oh my God, I didn't know that was going to happen. Or that's the big surprise. That's the big reveal. That's why it works. Cause I'm so bought in. I'm so down and in this movie. I'm not taking a step back and looking around and going, wait a minute, what's likely happening next? Where are these characters going? And so you can kind of use those as sort of a predictive analysis tool, even when you're watching a movie.
Exactly.
Now it takes away from your enjoyment of the movie because you're doing the map chart in your head going, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. And you also have to suspend disbelief. But here's what I kind of wanted to get at, that the background fluff, the set dressing in a film, the background characters are just as important as anything else that's going on. In fact, that's what sets the baseline for everything. So in order to have like a compelling conversation between two characters where you're bought in and all they're doing is having a coffee in a diner, you have to hear the plates rattling. You have to hear someone pouring coffee. You have to see the waitress walking around. You have to see the couple sitting
there. Immerse yourself.
So the idea is, so when it comes to, that's what we kind of have people focus on, right? It's like, okay, extract normalcy from the environment.
The smell, the feel, the taste, the atmospherics, exactly.
So that background, literally like set dressing, you know, almost on those films, that's how life works, is like all of that background noise, everything that's happening, that's where you get what's going on in the situation. It's not the novel thing that pops up in the main character that walks in, because that's easy.
You're making me so angry now because what you're doing unintentionally or deliberately, because Brian, you got to know, fires on a bunch of channels. He's like a sprinkler all at once, is you're making our argument why sometimes VR and AI builders make a mistake.
Yes.
Because they think that VR and AI are a film. It's a movie. And so, therefore, that character has to be so compelling that I want to pay attention to that character in that moment. You, does he have a gun? What's going on? All that. But in reality, when we're dealing with police work or emergency services or response, it's all those things on the way to the call that matter. Mm-hmm. It's all that when I got out, when I dismounted, did I have to run to the scene or walk to the scene? Were sirens blaring or weren't they blaring? So when you and I are talking about being purists in there, we're talking about exactly that HPP RNA that we're talking about, films and novels and all the other things. In a novel, if we just came up and said Junior was raped in prison, tomorrow he got a job, Thursday he got fired. Okay, listen, if you don't do the color along with the play-by-play, people are tuning the F out.
That's why you got to do the montage, right? Where they play the music and they go through all that stuff and you see, oh, they're prepping for this. They're buying the guns, or they're running on the beach and they're high-fiving and whatever. Perfect.
I have to, for example, that's the old guy, but he's still in pretty good shape. So you got to watch him. Go back to the Sopranos. there was one episode where Junior shoots Soprano and he's trying to get back into it, and he's well over 300 pounds and he's not healthy. And so he's back at the Banger, Satriale's, one of the places that the film's already going. And he's got one of the security guards there. It's a young kid that was used to, you know, play, you know, college ball. He's a big kid. So he looks around and all the young guys are in shape and all the old gangsters are fat and out of shape and droopy. So he goes, man, I got to appear strong. So what's he do? He picks a fight with that kid, bums rushes him and knocks him out. Okay, that's great. You know why? Because we've all felt those emotions. So building up to it, they took days and weeks and months of other episodes to show you that one point in film. And yeah. I think that's magic, right? When Corleone in The Godfather, Corleone kid has to walk into the bathroom, Michael, and find the gun behind the shitter and go out and kill those two guys. And you knew about it. You knew about it because an hour into the movie, they were already planning that assassination. But Brian, like Hitchcock, you had to wait for that. Mm-hmm. Holy shit. This is why when films allow the escapist fantasy and they're realistic, cognitively close enough, and we can associate with a part of it, or we can step into a role that we've always wondered about and then step right back out safely, man, that's magic. That's what I'm talking about, security blanket. And those are the films you'll go back to over and over and over.
Yeah, no, and that's it. It's you know, obviously we suspend disbelief. It's close enough to, it's cognitively close enough to reality, but it allows us all to play matters in all these different areas. And so we can, obviously that's meant to be used as a tool, and everything that goes on in those films is supporting the storyline and driving it forward, right? Yep. And so it, you know, it allows us, that's where, you know, you can create suspense by putting in these little clues or cues, you know, within there, and they're all there. And it just, oh man, that was the, you know, the Sixth Sense where everyone goes, oh man, whenever the red was on, right, so you know,
you were spot on with that. Okay. So here's the thing. First of all, shout out to Darcy Lutzinger, Dr. Darcy Lutzinger, brought realism to so many films for a decade. His company exemplified training people on how to clear buildings and do those things as a cop with a lot of training experience. Love that. Love when you do that. If you don't do that, then what you do is you make a hot bag of shit that while we're watching it, we go, nobody would do that. Like, for example, I need to show you holding a gun.
Yeah. So I put it up
in the frame, holding up by my head. I know dead people. To your
Sixth Sense. Dead people.
I've seen that because of that. But a quick Sixth Sense film, you were talking about, most people don't dissect everything. We're loving life, Brian and I, and the people that we work with, because we do dissect everything. And we found that that's a tremendous thing. Nothing surprises you, and have a good time. So we're in Vail, Colorado, and Vail has a theater, used to, that had reclining chairs and had drink holders, and there was a bar, and they would mix your drinks for you. And there was only a limited amount of people that could go in. It was real frou-frou, and it was right down the street from Avon where we were coppers, and we were working on the drug team. So it was Shelly and I, and it was Jay, Lucky, Cease, and his wife. And so they go, hey, you got to, you know, Jay, hey, man, you got to see him. And what's that, mumbles? Hey, we got to go see this film. It just came out at this cool theater. So we went up, and the experience was completely different for Shelly and I that had gone to Detroit theater. So it was the Sixth Sense. So we're to the point in the Sixth Sense where they introduced Haley Joel Osment. Okay, just after the shooting, just after the bed, spoiler alert, turned the channel. And Shelly looks at me and goes, something with the color red. And I go, yeah. And I think he got killed. And she goes, what do you mean? I go, well, think about it. He's already dead. And then Cease goes, yeah, that's it. So he sees dead people. And it was well before they said it. The people around us, shit. Okay, they were all so pissed. They wanted to get up and walk out of the theater. And it was like, oh, sorry. What were we doing? We were familiar enough with this movie, having never seen it before, that we were discussing, here again, socialization. A film allowed us to be closer in that moment and use our skill to dissect it. But guess what? We pissed everybody else off because we called it like we saw it, and we should have shut up, you know?
No, it's anything so that different. Gets injected into the storyline. I can't remember what we were watching one time, and I'm going like, I started like, shit, I'm like, what's going on here? And like, Michaela's like, what? I go, all right, remember like 15 minutes ago where the guy came by and he stopped by those? That made no fucking sense. Who is that? Right. He's coming back in the movie. Like, I know there's something up with it. There's something there, because that scene just is so incongruent with everything else that is happening. It was intentional. It wasn't just to build, it didn't add to the storyline. And that's so no smart. Different than HBPRNA and what we talked talk about when someone, you know, when you're dissecting anything, it's like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense to fit the storyline. This doesn't make sense if you're really going to pick your kid up from wherever, or you just came back from the store and you're telling me that no, that you wouldn't do these things, right? Because it doesn't add to what
that's predictive
what
analysis.
Doing. Yes.
We create explanatory storylines for a situation. Look, if this guy's this pissed, he's going to tip over the table. If this guy's this pissed, he's going to throw a punch. If this guy's this pissed, he's going to say a swear. If this guy's this pissed, he's going to drop his beer and turn around and storm out of the place and squeal off. Okay, so there's, let's say, 5 or 6 possible, and they're much more likely than the 140th one is the guy's going to do a ballet thing and turn over and fart, right? I mean, we can dismiss those. But on those top 5, what would happen next to create that likelihood? Well, he would have to ball his fist or lean in or grab the table. So if it doesn't fit, Brian, the isotoner must have quit. If it does not fit, we have to look at it and say, is this a sound hypothesis? What is that called? Scientific hypothesis testing.
Testing, right? Yeah.
So the problem with small control samples is that you come up with skewed and varied results that might not inform you of a likelihood. We have an advantage because it's billions upon billions of people that go through their day every day repeating the behavior. So
yeah.
our sample is significantly larger and it's been tested for thousands of years.
And so here's the analogy to sort of real life. You don't, when you're observing a situation, a person, whatever, you're not starting at the beginning of the movie. You're coming in at some point on that timeline, and that's where your observation starts. And you, unless someone told you, unless you got to review something, unless you had some other information, you don't know everything that led up to it. But even small pieces of information can allow you to infer what likely occurred before and therefore what likely is going to occur next. So meaning if you, so we just talked about movies for 40 minutes. You can go drop into whatever, let's say, like action movies, those things are like set fucking storyline. All of them are exactly the same, which is why I don't get into like all the Marvel superhero ones and all the CGI stuff. It's just not for me. It's not my thing because
protracted fist fight.
Well, and they're lame to me. Like you always say too, it's like, wait, you've got all this power, all this technology, all this, then why does it always end up with a fist fight between two guys? Like,
exactly.
But it's always that way. I come from another planet.
But
they're extremely popular because they're fun and they're exciting and they're entertaining. And it's wild to see what you can do with that stuff. I mean, they're impressive. It's just not my thing. But the idea is, you know, even though you can walk into the middle of any major, big, popular movie, watch it for 5 minutes and come up with, okay, here's what I think this movie is about. And here's where the characters, you're going to get a lot of that right. You're not going to get the whole thing. You're not going to get everything because everything fits a set sort of pattern. There's a subtle small details are going to be different, but the big storylines are going to fit a certain pattern. So all I need to do is figure out what's the big storyline here, right? And that'll allow me to create those options that I need or create potential outcomes or those hypotheses to test within the situation.
So there's a great copper out there that's come to a course and we've talked to him before on various issues, Greg Primm. And Primm does exactly what you do in his daily life.
Yeah.
He has to quickly assess the surroundings based on all the things that he knows and the experiences that he's had. And there's a story that goes along with the stuff that he's watching. And guess what? When everything fits that story, it feels pretty good. But every once in a while, he comes up with something that doesn't fit the storyline. And he goes and he makes a traffic stop and he scores. What he had trouble with is turning around and explaining that in a manner. Now, I'm not saying he lost any cases and didn't write great reports and couldn't testify. I'm saying he didn't see the HBPRNA, which opens up, Brian, when you're driving, a movie is like the windshield on your car. Mm-hmm. I show you what I want you to see. Mm-hmm. HBPRNA is like sitting on the roof of your car.
And you need to look all around.
Holy shit. You know, it's the Hoberman, Brian. I can see 360 up and down and backwards, and I can feel the wind in my face. So the idea was that Primm was able to take our information and go so much further. And he's constantly on a search. We know a lot of people that are always out there searching. But I love knowing that we've given somebody the opportunity to look at something and literally and figuratively, pick it up off the table and turn it around in their hand and see what's really going on. And a film doesn't allow us to do that. So that's why films are so important, because we have to fill in the blanks. They can't tell us everything. Shelley and I have a term, and you just mentioned it, but with different terminology. They did that for us. So we'll see a part of a film and they'll, you know, flash something for a minute. And it's like, okay, they did that for us. Or the guy said, well, you remember, Tommy, when we were younger, they did that for us. They had to give us something now so we would extrapolate that information later. And life does that. We call those pre-event indications of something, right? So whenever I see cues and clusters of cues coalesce in my environment, I come up with likelihood. And that's the key. And so when we watch a film, you and I watch it a little differently because we're constantly using different lenses.
Yeah.
And sometimes we'll watch the film two or three times to make sure that we caught what we think the message was.
And, you know, you brought up that's a perfect example, you know, in film and then in life, is that it's the film you're watching, it's forced perspective. You only get what that director had in mind for you to see, right? So that's what other people will try to do, and only whether it's for nefarious purposes, illegal purposes, or something they don't want you to do,
bamboozle
or know,
you,
whatever it is,
to pickpocket you, or during an interview to lie to you.
Exactly, everything is that forced perspective. But
look over here.
But here's the thing: in real life, you get to do that. You don't get that. You don't have to sit in the car and stare at the windshield. You can stop. You can pull over. You can take a look around. You can look up out of the window. You can look at the rearview mirror. That's the difference in life. Is that, you know, in those movies, it's so forced and you only get what they want, and people will try to do that to you, but you get everything, right? You get to look around a little bit. You get to step left or right and see it from that different perspective. You get to turn around and see what's coming behind you. It's just a great way of understanding how we get sucked in to staring and looking and watching at something that is meaningless, you know what I mean, or doesn't matter as much as we think it does.
So you're so spot on. And remember, folks, when we talk about reboots, we're talking about films that have been made over and over and over. Perfect example, Brewster's Millions has been made. Very simple thing. I've got to spend $1 million without amassing any property value or any tangible things, and then I get $10 million at the end of the day, kind of thing. That's been remade 6 or 8 times. Christmas Carol over 20 times. So when we take a look at those, we have to think of when the formula works, people jump at it. So can I give evidence of that? Yeah. So Brian, during the 50s and 60s, the most popular TV shows, serials, movies, everything on were Westerns. A psych student asked me one time at Western, no pun intended, why was that? And so my thing is, well, if you have a lot of volcanoes, or there was a lot of bad weather, or there was a lot of plane hijackings, you can expect very quickly 2 or 3 movies to come out about that. A lot of scripts going out about that because people want to avail themselves of it. But when it comes to Westerns, take a look at how people think. Even European people go, oh, cowboy, bang, bang,
I get it.
Right? And then what do we think? The white hat and the black hat and the good and the evil. And man, God made people, but, you know, cult, made this guy more powerful, whatever the code is. I don't give a shit about it. But you understand that you couldn't get away from Bonanza and Gunsmoke and the Rifleman and Wagon Train, Have Gun Will Travel. And that even carried over to the cartoons that were made. And you talked about prequels and sequels. So if Hollywood was still doing Westerns, we would have Gun Will Travel High School Edition. We would have Wagon Train before the wagon was built, and it would be a red wagon, and they would be doing it in the yard of the guy's house. Look, we even have Muppet Babies. Why? Because Muppets are popular. So if I can take the baby Muppets, maybe a kid will associate, right? I saw a commercial the other day, and they had a guy going down, and which looked like an ice cream truck, and a bunch of kids ran him down, and it was about sports, watching sports on TV. It had nothing to do with ice cream and shit. And the kids were going, oh, so I'll watch with my parents. Yeah, and I'll watch alone. And I'll watch the playoffs that are coming up. Listen, Hollywood makes those type of commercials because they also make sports book in Vegas. And I want to start people, you know, spending money on their phones earlier and earlier. That's not film. That's not that genre. That's using these masterful arts for the dark side. And you were just touching on that, right? That's showing a Japanese person with the yellow skin and the slanted eyes, or a Nazi with the big helmet. And so it's a propagandist or a psychological warfare way of looking at it. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about when something seems to be popular, everything follows suit. Why? Mm-hmm. Because it works. Yeah. When somebody comes up with a new burger or sandwich, the competitors have to come up with one too. So we drive the industry by driving to the industry to watch the film.
Yeah.
And the more we take shit from those films, you know, the crappy films, the more crappy films they're going to throw at us. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's that's you can even get in that with the big major films where they shoot multiple endings and multiple storylines, and they have focus groups to see which one goes well. And it's like, you know, it's not really a creative vision anymore. It's just literally falling into that algorithm that I know it's going to be a hit and it's going to make a ton of money. It's not even about telling a compelling story. It's just, you know, it's literally just, we're going to make this because we know it's going to do $100 million in the box office. Yep. And so, I mean, which that's the business side of it, of course. But you know, there's so many different analogies in the movie and TV industry that there are just to real life because of that. And again, it goes back to, it's really hard to be novel and creative and do something that, like, where you can't, where you won't get caught. It's hard to do that, where to go come up with something so unique that no one's ever seen it before. So why is that any different for a criminal than it is a terrorist?
It's movie. HPPRA 101. Why do we both love Christopher Walken? Because Christopher Walken decides the pace of his speech. Yeah. He decides how he's going to read it. He takes out all of the periods and exclamation points and does his own thing.
But that only works for him.
Yes, that's no what I'm saying. Nobody else. Yeah, okay, yeah. Kevin Spacey. Kevin Spacey. Oh, yeah. When Kevin Spacey goes off the res, and says, "Shut your mouth and listen to what I say," and all that.
Now, that's him.
It's because and I bet there's a big part of that in his real life too.
I think so. You know, and from what I've heard,
I don't want to get sued with that one because I think he was on that rant.
I don't know
that video you sent me about Epstein's release, the idea here is that I revere Kevin Spacey as an actor, because when you watch The Usual Suspects, whether you loved it or you hated it, how he was manipulative and how he moved through that character, it was amazing to watch. Pulp Fiction, Walken's role in Pulp Fiction stole the film for me.
Yeah.
Okay. Because when I've been walking around, it was magic. Nobody else could. Could you imagine that stage read? Which leads me to a great film. You and I both know this, the story about the front page. And the front page was remade with His Girl Friday. And so you got Cary Grant that goes in with Rosalind Russell, Ralph Bellamy, all those other people, and they're all reading for the roles. And every single time the His Girl Friday was made from the front page, which has been remade 25 times, Walter Burns and his news partner, the reporter, remember there was written news and there were newspapers, was going to leave. And so he tried to get his Hildy, his partner, to come back. And it was always two males. So as they were sitting in the room with Cary Grant and Ralph Bellamy doing the cold reading on the script, right, for who was going to be the characters, the male part that was going to play Hildy couldn't make it. So one of the producers had his female secretary, "Hey, do me a favor, step in and read it." And all of them at once had the epiphany moment, Brian. They go, "Holy shit, we can redo this whole film with a male and a female character. And now we've got all this other stuff."
Yeah.
I love that. To me, that's magic. To me, that's somebody, you know, doing the Christopher Walken, showing me something that I didn't see before. You know, the idea of them being able to take that film and putting a different spin on it, I love that. Now, I have to walk that back because they just made Winnie the Pooh as a serial killer, and what? It's, you know, blood on the honey or whatever. God, and so they just came out with Mickey Mouse, which is going to be released very soon. Mickey Mouse is a serial killer and does all the Friday the 13th.
That's your trying to,
you get what I'm saying? That's changing some. Not interested. Not interested in blood and gore and violence. I've had enough in my life. I don't need to see an effing movie. All I got to do is close my eyes. You know what I'm saying? Or get with you and cry in the rental car all the way to the training. But when you take a look at the films that are the most remade films, there's one of two things that sticks out to me, Brian. One, moneymaker. Mm-hmm. Bona fide moneymaker. Yep. Or the second, A Star Is Born. people are fragile and they're vulnerable. And when they become successful, they delve into womanizing and drugs and everything else, which, by the way, is the Sopranos 101 and everything that you saw in Godfather all the way up to the last one. Dracula and Frankenstein. Why did those come? Because you know what? I heard a bump in the night and I created all kind of shit for it, right?
Yep.
The science going too far. Frankenstein, nobody even knows unless they actually read the book. Frankenstein going up into the Antarctic and being alone. There's magic there. Magnificent Seven. Akira Kurosawa did The Seven Samurai. Robin Hood. Why? Robin Hood is one of the most remade films of all time. Why, though? Because what's the point there?
Right. Hey, getting taken back from at the rich. Man. Yep.
You know what I'm saying?
I
love that. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. What if you walked by a butcher shop and you thought, man, if I worked there, I'd be 400 pounds because I like me some hamburger or whatever, right? Those things are going to constantly be popular in film. And you know what I can't get behind? I can't get behind Avatar. And I sound like a dick because Avatar might be a great film, but now they made Avatar Way of Water. I heard the next one coming out, Avatar Way of Sand. Then it's Avatar Way of Chocolate. Holy shit. How many times can you use these sea monkeys and turn them into something that I want to watch? You know? Yeah.
No, and this is where it comes about, you know, obviously individual tastes or what you see in the films. And
that's
then,
the socialization.
And then too, like the predictive part of it when I'm like, you know, once obviously because we're prime, we do pattern recognition and analysis. Like you, once you see it, it's kind of like, oh, I kind of know what's coming. I don't know it specifically. I can't tell you, oh, at this minute, someone's going to walk in and that's when the shooting starts. It's like, all right, then this is going to happen. So there has to be something engaging in there for me to get into those movies. And so, but the CGI one stuff too is and Kaylee always gives me shit. She's like, you don't like all these because it's just like, oh, that's not how it really happens. Or something. I go, but if I'm going to suspend disbelief and I'm going to get into it, I can do that. It has to be engaging on a level where I'm not sure where it's going to go. So there's some novelty there.
Exactly.
And there's a little bit of suspense.
Or you're in a coma, Brian. Huge. I'm a huge J.R.R. Tolkien fan from the Silmarillion. Silmarillion on up. I've read J.R.R. Tolkien shit he's written on a napkin. Why? Because I think it's fascinating that this guy came up with a world and a language and such robust fidelity filled characters and such unique thing. And guess what? It's the Seven Samurai over and over and over. Okay?
Yeah.
But he didn't have those next to him when he was writing. He was in this fantastic place. Now, I don't binge watch. I can't watch more than a few minutes of when the films come on because I was duped by the books and I felt myself there. So I go, oh, that's who they got to play that. Or I'll see Smaug the Dragon go in and I'll go, well, I was a little different. So I actually love Tolkien, but I hate the films.
Well,
that's
because, you know, if you read it as a book and then you watch the movie, it's going to be different than the story you created in your head. Because when you're reading it from book, obviously you're creating the characters. It's all the information's in there, but your brain puts those together and what it looks like and what it feels like, what it smells like and all that.
Yep.
So then that's why a lot of people go, well, I like the book better than the film. It's because that was someone else's vision of that story. And that's all stories. That's all information, whether they're real, whether it's fiction, whether anything, you create the storyline in your head and it's different. Even when you're watching the film, you're creating something that's different. It's a different experience for you than it is the person sitting next to you because they're adding in their own details or own attributes or personality traits on that individual that may not even be represented on the screen, but we
created them.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? We built them in our mind and they're solid. And you just touched on the physiological again and the psychological, the safety net. Brian, when I don't have to work very, my brain and body loves sitting in a chair and not having to walk the dog and not having to go outside and shovel the snow, not having to get up and walk downstairs to the gym because my leg hurts a little today.
Yeah. Right?
The films that we love the most allow us to sit back and go, here we go again.
Yep.
It's like heroin, man. And it really is because we get the same synaptic high and low from those films. As a matter of fact, that's why when we hear a couple of notes from a song or the intro voice from the movie or whatever it is, the Gottfried in the background, we're there, man. We're immediately transported there. And we all know that it's your mind's ability to create those connections and to refer to those connections is why things like masturbation work. We love that high. We love those lows. Brian, crying is absolutely essential to humans. And it flushes our system and releases endorphins that are very powerful to us. Laughing does exactly the same. You think that's accidental? Come on.
No,
And what is the sign for Hollywood? The happiness and the tragedy, you know, the sadness? Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, people knew that, Brian. Our Stoics were talking about that on the, you know, steps of the porn theater, you know, thousands of years ago, you know, Brian, they were only wearing togas.
Yeah.
But they were going at each other all the time.
There's a lot going on back then.
But that's why I mean, I loved when you came to me with the idea moments before we filmed that we're not going to just talk about songs. Hey, we're going to talk about film because you know how much I love it. And the films that I love are always ones that take me places.
Yeah.
They make me laugh or they make me cry or they make me anticipate something that's going to happen. And I go, I see what you did there. And that's clever. I love that shit. You know, that's a Mike Myers line, by the way. May I add just one more thing for you?
Sure.
You were talking about Freddie Mercury, which you looked like a week ago.
I did.
And acted like for the last 10 years. But the idea is that Mercury, portrayal by that great young actor.
Yeah, I forget his name. He's great.
He did such a great job. And I got to watch that film because you and I were traveling a lot. And it was one that I could get on my phone that was long enough and it had music and it had a little interest. So I watched that. And you said, hey, the protracted use of the too many teeth and all that other stuff, I think they, you know, overdid that. When a movie goes so far that they have to be exact, to go right back to our AI VR fight. I need to make everything exact. I need to make the type of holster and make sure that it's got the recoil and shit.
You don't need
it. All you got to do is get me there. I'll do the rest.
Yeah.
Again, we're back to masturbation. But the idea is all you have to do is give me the vehicle. The film is a vehicle for me to experience all these profound life-altering emotions. And that's why you don't need to go too far.
Yeah. No, and that's what you see that on too many where they explain it too much or they go too far. I mean, it's back to your Sopranos. When I watched that when they came out a couple of years ago with like they came out with a movie like follow up, sort of like it's like it was like a prequel of everything that happened before. And it was good. It was I got into it, but it was like too on the nose and too like they went into too much detail. Like there was a scene where it was baby Christopher and it was a young Tony and like Christopher was fine with everyone else and didn't like Tony, but then they had to like point, like it was obvious, but then they're like, oh wow, he doesn't like Tony. Wow. They're foreshadowing the fact that Tony ends up killing him or whatever. But like, it was like, you don't have to go, you're going too far. Like just, you know, make subtle hints. Don't, you know,
we're back to talking the Oberman series that we're working currently with Milo on, but anybody knock on the door, we're interested. The idea is that when we create AI and VR, we have to fight the urge to build the entire Millennium Falcon. You get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Because when they did that, Han and Luke were the most important things, not the visual effects. It was what might happen next. And so those ideas, Brian, that's the best films in the world. The best films have a good plot. And again, if they don't go too long, we have fun. And you know what? It's just like a roller coaster. I get off the roller coaster. I get back in line. Why? Endorphins. I don't get back in line for any other reason other than the chemicals that made me feel in a certain way. I want to do it again. And you know who doesn't get back on? The kid that vomited at the top. That kid's probably not going to go back there. So don't make me vomit at your film, I think is the tagline here. No, the idea is, man, look, film can transform your life. So it's just like music, just like literature. And if you understand more about HBPRNA, you're going to enjoy film more. You really are.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's a good spot to end on unless you have any other.
I wanted to do one more Christopher Walken.
Oh, God.
I can't do a Kevin Spacey. Shelley does a great Kevin Spacey. Next time you're with Shelley, when Shelley talks office politics and she goes the Kevin Spacey route, it's hilarious. You got to watch it.
Yeah, it's you always kind of devolve somehow to Gilbert Gottfried on all your impressions.
Gottfried! I don't know why.
I don't know why.
Exactly. Everything in my life is that commercial where Gottfried was the goose or the duck.
If Seth MacFarlane falls through is doing the audio book for the textbook as the voice of Peter Griffin. If we can't get him, then we'll get Gilbert Godfrey.
First of all, that's insulting, and I get it, and it's funny, so I'll allow it. But I think that it should be Morgan Freeman.
Oh, that'd be great.
Morgan Freeman can.
He's got a great voice. Right? Yeah, he can.
And then for me, it should be Godfrey. So no matter what I do, like in the textbook, even during the episode, chapter four. You know, the book on tape. We talk about that. Stephen Drum, you know, try to get somebody. I don't want me talking. I always hear me. I want somebody else talk.
That'd be funny, though. I like the Peter Griffin one.
Yeah, I know.
That would be good. Bastard. I think that would be hilarious.
That makes you know what Brian the dog.
You know what grinds my gears? So
exactly. It's true. I look like him.
All right.
About as much as he does.
That's good.
Well, now that I'm insulted, I got to go eat.
We always have more on the Patreon site for those who are listening, and we got some big changes coming up there. It's going to be great, and I think everyone's going to like, and we got some great feedback from our Patreon folks on that. So we'll stay tuned in the next few weeks here as we kind of change a little bit on the podcast. Still going to be us, still doing what we're doing, but I think we'll be able to really knock it out of the park for everyone listening. So we thank everyone for listening. We appreciate it, and don't forget that training changes behavior. That's all for today, folks, but if you'd like even more content, you can head over to our Patreon page. The link can be found in the episode details. Please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, follow us on social media, and please tell your friends about the show. Thanks for tuning in, and we appreciate your support.